Hi everyone, my name is Amandine Flax and welcome to a new episode of Entrepreneurs Playing Games podcast edition. Every 2 weeks I host a live video stream where I deep dive into startup founders' journey after playing video games with my guests. Here is the audio version of our discussion. If you are interested in the full video, be sure to check out and follow my YouTube channel at youtube.com/AmandineFlax. And for any questions, suggestions, or just to say hi, you can find me on Twitter at AmandineFlax or at EntrepreneursPG. In today's episode, I am joined by Tadas, CEO and founder of Prodsight. People may have spotted you in the news over the past few days. There have been quite some good coverage for you after your announcement of closing your pre-seed round.
Yes.
So that's a fantastic news for you. And I have many questions about that. But first thing first, I want to know more about Prodsight, what it is.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, happy to tell you more. So Prodsight is a company that came from my own problem that I had as working as a product manager before. Mm-hmm. In a startup company. So for me as a product manager, it's very important to know what the user needs are. So once we identify the market segment we want to target, what these people need, how can we help them with our product or service? And I found that the best way to do that is to obviously speak with them. But as your organization scales, you kind of lose that personal touch where you cannot necessarily speak with every user one-to-one, and you end up getting feedback from many other sources asynchronously. So it might be support tickets that people raise, it might be survey responses, it might be reviews that someone writes about your product. And you know, as in the company I was at, as we started scaling that, I kind of, as a product manager, I felt that I lost touch with those users, and I didn't necessarily understand what the recurring themes were. And when that happens, you start prioritizing based on your gut. So when you do that, you introduce risk into your process. You know, you made an assumption about what your users need, you build something on that assumption, and then if it doesn't happen to be right, you might have either a failed feature or you missed an opportunity. You know, a competitor maybe got it better than you, and you kind of lose that edge. Mm-hmm. So as I was working at the startup, I started kind of thinking about this problem more and more, and you know, different processes I could use. So I obviously built an Excel spreadsheet. I had an Airtable. Mm-hmm. I had some integrations I did with Zapier. So it was like trying to build a solution. Then I kind of spoke to a few other product managers I knew, and I said, how do you manage this mm-hmm. process? And they kind of told me similar stories, ranging from, we don't do anything, we just kind of like get like a rough idea or rely on anecdotes, or they would have some kind of elaborate system okay. that they built themselves. But no one actually had like an off-the-shelf tool. Like nowadays, if you want a CRM, you would just go and choose HubSpot mm-hmm. or Pipedrive or something like that. When you want to analyze your feedback at scale, there's not that many solutions you could try, especially on a smaller end of the market. So that's the kind of core reason why I started Prodsight. But what it ended up being is it's kind of a few parts. So the first part is getting that data into one place, mm-hmm. aggregating it together, and then running some kind of automated process that analyzes your data, extracts key themes, analyzes sentiment, and then helps anyone in your company who's interested in learning about customer needs to surface those insights in real time. Mm. So at the moment, Prodsight integrates with three different systems. We do Intercom, Zendesk, and Freshdesk. And we have built this automated process that does the thematic and sentiment analysis. And we now have live customers since March last year using this product as part of their product management process.
So your target audience, if I understand correctly, are people who are already using some tools for customer support, to manage customer support, and you come on the top of that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So you know, that was the premise for me. I wanted to make this product very simple. So if you use something like one of those systems I mentioned, you could just plug in but in one click, and then it kind of runs on top of that. So
how easy is it for people to do that, to make this one click, to connect their own like Zendesk or Freshdesk your solution?
That's a good question. So with Intracom, we have a very simple integration where it's a simple, you know, as signing in with your Google account or Facebook account on like a third-party site. So it's literally you click, you authorize the permissions, and then it just runs in the background.
Okay.
With Zendesk and Freshdesk, it's a little bit more complicated. You need an API key, but that is easy enough to get and takes, you know, up to 2 minutes to get that done.
Yes. I think today lots of people are kind of familiar with the process of just copying and pasting your API key, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Great. Also, interestingly, there have been a press release recently about your fundraising, and in this I found a quote from you that I found super interesting about data. So you said that companies today manage 3 times more data than they used to 5 years ago. And I'm wondering, do you think that it is a huge problem for companies today? Mm-hmm. Do you think that they're kind of overwhelmed by the quantity of data they have access to, plus the data they're generating, and they're kind of struggling all together trying to make sense of all that?
I mean, absolutely. And, you know, a few years back, there was this big data movement where companies tried to crunch large, you know, data volumes. They would use data warehouse, and they still use today.
Mm-hmm.
It's just maybe not as popular now. But a lot of that data was quantitative data. So it would be numbers, maybe transactional data, possibly analytics data, where you can analyze these units together without necessarily having to extract some meaning.
Mm-hmm.
The data we're focused on is inherently unstructured. So it'd be literally sentences or pieces of text. You know, by themselves, you need to apply natural language processing on top to be able to say, you know, this piece of text is mentioning these three things,
mm-hmm.
and then finding across thousands of pieces of that kind of text or tickets, finding those themes, like how many people talk about this theme versus that theme, which one is trending, which one is actually going down, which is a good thing. You know, if people start complaining about something, it means either you fixed it or the problem went away. So you're now able to take something that's inherently unstructured and something you would read as a qualitative source into something that you could measure and turn into numbers, essentially.
I see. Who did you find first the data to train your technology on? Did you have your own data? Did you kind of pilot with other people to kind of deep dive into their own data and test the project on their own data first?
Yeah, so because I was starting very lean, and the first year, most part of the year was me bootstrapping this
mm-hmm.
alone. So I was very keen to create something that allowed me to incrementally validate my idea so I don't build the wrong thing.
Yes.
Because the risk was like I go on the wrong path, I fail, and then I don't have a startup. So the very first prototype I built was a very simple tool that connects to Intracom and allows
mm-hmm.
users to export a transcript of their messages, which they could easily then import into Excel and do their own kind of keyword searches or whatever. So that was my very first experiment to, first of all, test whether users would be comfortable connecting to a third party for this part of the job that I wanted to do, and whether they would pay me anything. So the initial starting point was $5 per month.
Okay.
And all it did is just gets you these exports. So I launched the company in September 2017 registered the company.
Mm-hmm.
And then a month later, I had my first customer in the U.S.,
that's
who
nice.
Connected, you know, their data source, and they actually still to this day, they're still using that tool. I didn't kill it off. but for me, that was less about being able to sell something and more about validating those assumptions. So will people connect the data source? Yes. Will they pay something to help me solve part of the problem? And then I could then ask them questions like, what are you trying to do with this data? What kind of analysis are you doing? And then that became the foundation of the next step of ProdSight, which is another prototype product I built, which from the front-end perspective is very similar in that, you know, it had a simple dashboard you log into, connect your data source, but the actual analysis of the data was done by me behind the scenes.
Okay.
So I would sell these packages of analysis, or say I would analyze your 1,000 tickets per month for like $200. And I had a bunch of companies sign up for that. And, you know, on Saturdays or Sundays, or whenever I had some spare time, I would read those conversations, analyze them, apply the appropriate tags, and then the reporting would kind of trickle down to the user. So that actually, we got that to about $1,000 per month in MRR over a few months. And that became the foundation, which allowed me to raise funding. So I'm not an NLP expert myself. I couldn't build the automated system, but I went as far as I could with my own skills to basically validate that this is a problem, there's a market for it. Only if I could hire the experts here to help me with this, we would build the product and then take off.
I love how you really quickly managed to get customers, and that really quickly, as soon as you register the business, you immediately were focused on just getting something out there, getting your first customers, getting people, your product in the people's hands, and getting feedback on that, and just, you know, iterating super fast. I mean, people generally try to do that, but you don't necessarily do it in a month or in 3 months. You kind of generally always push a bit. So that's super interesting. I love that.
Well, thank you. You know, that's something that a lot of product management literature is about. And I think in the first few years at a startup I was working at, I was trying to apply these lessons, but didn't necessarily got them right at the first try. And I think when I, you know, left that company to do my own startup, I kind of felt like I had a few passes at this kind of MVP approach, and I was better informed as to different approaches I could try to minimize the cost of building something and increase those iteration cycles.
We talked earlier about your startup ProdSight. You explain the model, how it works, and how it works with existing customer support tools. And I'm wondering how it's like to build your startup on the top of another product. If there is, I don't know, any specific risk, difficulties, or opportunities maybe to take in consideration when you're doing so. Because I know many founders that have been looking at this kind of model, but they don't necessarily know where to start or how to approach that, looking that you don't necessarily, you're not in control of the tool that you're building on the top of, or building, just integrating with your tool. So how does this work for you, and did you find anything harder with you?
Yeah, I think my view in general of, you know, creating products is, if there's something out there that you don't need to replicate, if something works, don't need to reinvent it, right? So, you know, we could have went with the approach of, you know, import your data, or maybe even create a feedback collection tool where it's like, okay, implement this in your product and collect feedback, and then we're going to analyze it. But, you know, that would introduce barriers. You know, potential customers might say, oh, I actually already have data and it's coming from these sources. I don't want another tool. I'm not sure if people are gonna engage with it, you know, introduces risk. So for me, it's like, how can I reduce the barriers to go from, if you are a product manager, you want to understand what your customers are saying, what would be the fastest way for us to help you get there? And then we were basically thinking, where's the existing data? Like, is there existing data that could give you that insight? And where is it located? And we didn't just come up with that idea ourselves. We actually did about 30 interviews with various different people. Actually, in some cases, I would offer them like a $15 Amazon voucher or a Starbucks voucher or whatever to, you know, for their time to speak with me. And I would ask questions like, where's your customer feedback stored? What sources is it coming from? Which ones are most important? Which ones are highest volume? You know, what do you do to analyze? Basically, based on this data, I deduced that the support in the growing companies, the support channel is the biggest by volume. So, and it only, like, the more successful you are, the faster it grows.
Yes.
So it was a natural choice for us, kind of thinking like, what are the top solutions for support? And let's integrate with them and use that as a starting point and then grow from there. So we don't want to be focused on support forever. We want to do, you know, the top 5 or 10 systems, and then move on to, you know, top 5 survey systems, top 5 review systems, possibly look at social media as well, whatever kind of makes sense in terms of what feedback our customers are valuing, you know, and that way we can aggregate this customer feedback and build on top of existing data sources. Now, to come back to your question of the risks or opportunities with that, I think because we are looking at common denominator across those channels, so we're not integrating into something like Slack where we live literally within their walls, mm-hmm. and do some service, and then if they change something, you know, our product kind of changes. We actually just ingest data from these systems that is standardized across Intercom, across Zendesk. You know, the data models they use are very similar. It would be, you know, a user sends a ticket, and then that ticket has like mentions, mm-hmm. or messages in it, and there would be attributes like, this is an agent that was supporting you, this is when it happened, you know, and this is the customer that was served. So in our data system, we have a standard data model, mm-hmm. and then we just match it from whatever system we're integrating with. So in the short term, obviously, you know, like one of these companies could say, we're going to build the functionality you're doing, yes. and that could kill off potentially like a customer stream for mm-hmm. us. But at the same time, you know, they have a suite of products themselves. They have other priorities. And, you know, although there's value to be had by this analytics layer on top of your customer feedback, that's not necessarily the core priority today. Mm-hmm. And also because we were more focused on that, this is like our bread and butter, we're likely to build something that's deeper than whatever end up being part of these companies' roadmaps. And on the positive side, we actually work pretty closely with our partners. For example, the Intercom, we, you know, go to their events. Mm-hmm. I actually met most of their partnerships team, either face-to-face or, you know, through kind of online chat. A lot of their partnerships team in San Francisco.
Okay.
I'm heading there next week, and
nice.
We might catch up with some people there. And we're trying to understand, what do they want the partners, how do you want the partners to add value? What kinds of things that their own customers are requesting? How can we mold our product to add more value? Mm-hmm. And obviously, from their perspective, you know, any partner that could provide the service to their customer as a third party means that they don't have to add that to their own roadmap, and they can focus on their core. So a lot of scaling companies like Intercom, like Zendesk, they have a lot of functionality in the suites of products, but then they augment that by having a partner marketplace, which basically whatever need your customer has, it's likely to be catered either by themselves or by a partner on the store.
Do you think that having this close relationship kind of help you, let's say, be here if one day they decide to, or kind of prevent the fact that they could decide to do it themselves, because you already have this relationship? So instead of being like, oh, someone in the world is doing this, you know them directly. So if they want to integrate it more within their offer, they mm-hmm. could just talk to you directly because it is here already and they don't have to recreate it completely.
Yeah, you know, obviously, you know, as a founder, you kind of think about your long-term game, you know, mm-hmm. and if you raise venture capital, the, you know, the exit that everyone's looking for,
yes.
is either, you know, a trade sale of some kind or an IPO, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, that return is still expected. So you kind of, in the back of your head, I think we're still so early in the journey. It's not, you know, we're not there to think about potential acquisitions, mm-hmm. but theoretically, someone could venture a guess that, you know, if you're adding value to platforms, you know, at some point, if the incentives align, there might be an interest, like, why don't we, you know, buy this company and add this capability, mm-hmm. instead of doing like years of R&D, because it's already kind of there and packaged and there's a team around it. So, but in the short term, I mean, we were focused on doing co-marketing activities, mm-hmm. you know, writing content that could be helpful both to our partners and explaining how a product works, how it adds value. And the way I see it, like every new integration we launch opens up another set of customers for us,
mm-hmm.
But also opens a marketing channel where you're visible in the App Store, and then
yes.
all these co-marketing activities we can do either offline or online could just enhance that and grow that.
Do you feel that it helps a lot on the customer acquisition? Or au contraire, you kind of have to fight to explain to people that it's on the top of what they're already using, so it's not going to replace what they're using. Or is it just facilitating just your access to customers?
I think it is at the moment facilitating, yeah. And maybe we got the message right, but for a lot of customers, they're like, I have Intercom, I have this problem, it looks like your platform can solve this. Let's jump on a call, mm-hmm. Let's just hash it out and see, you know, if it's something we could use. And we actually saw that for the customers that, you know, have this growing volume, they kind of losing touch with customers, wanna be more data-driven in their decision, you know, that's a phrase that kind of comes up a lot. This kind of feeling that, you know, are we really making these informed decisions or are we still hedging on our hunches? And yeah, the sales cycles we've seen are really quick when we find that match between mm-hmm. what the customer is doing and the problem and then our solution.
We have an interesting question from Federico. Hi, I hope you are doing well. I haven't seen you for the last episode, but I'm glad to see you here today. So Federico asks, can you tell us a point where you or your startup struggle and how you turn it around?
You know, you always get these little struggles and it seems like the end of the world, and then you get over it and then you're kind of like get ready for a bigger one. So to tell you an example, so after I raised funding in, I believe it was end of 2018, that was a small angel round that allowed me to bring two guys on board to help me build this new platform. So we started from scratch and kind of discarded my prototypes. And a few like months in, I think about 6 months in, one of these guys kind of felt like he wanted to move on and focus on other stuff, start his own consultancy, and didn't really want to continue with ProdSide at that point. And for me, it was like a big point was like, oh my God, like we're not going to be able to, you know, work on a roadmap. How am I going to find someone else? You know, it was already quite difficult, you know, mm-hmm. to get someone on board to join at this early stage. Yes. And we were not necessarily like in the place to pay market rates, even though we raised a bit of money. And I was like, oh, you know, it's going to be the end of it. But actually what happened is the remaining engineer, Marcel, who is our head of engineering right now, you know, he, you know, accepted the challenge and actually taught himself the remaining pieces of code base mm-hmm. and could actually maintain that over the coming months. So even until today, we didn't need to replace that talent. But now great. With this next round of funding, you know, we're going to bring that back, mm-hmm. You know, and increase our capacity and ability to do more things. So, you know, that's an example of what I've thought of at the time as the end of the world mm-hmm. turned around into something positive.
At the end, you have to make it happen anyway. So whatever happened, you have to find a way to overcome this, right?
Exactly.
You mentioned your fundraising, and I have lots of questions about that because, well, for lots of entrepreneurs, fundraising is a huge step. And also, it raises lots of questions, always. And I kind of hear always the same kind of questions. So I would like to know more about how it happened for you. So you announced this week that you closed your pre-seed round with an additional 400k of investment, mm-hmm. which is fantastic. Congratulations to you. And I'd like to know more about what was the hardest part on during this process.
Yeah, so I think the process or the learning of how fundraising works started, you know, when I did my first angel round. Mm-hmm. At that time, this idea of raising funds at the early stage, having never done that before, felt like, you know, who am I to raise funding? Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know investors personally. A lot of the advice that comes from the US or podcasts like Y Combinator is like, oh, just do your family and friends round. You know, unfortunately, sure. I didn't have investors or people those amounts of cash
yes.
as friends or family. So for me, it was going to be external investors. And I kind of went into that process quite dark. I knew roughly how it works, but I didn't necessarily know how to take an investor that you never met before into someone who says, yeah, I'm going to invest in your company. So there were a few key people that helped me get the first introductions, mm-hmm. and then that kind of got the ball rolling. So there's this guy in, I was based in Edinburgh at the time, and there was this guy who was running a small accelerator called Seed House.
Mm-hmm.
And I got introduced to him, and potentially we're talking about joining this fund, but the two roles I needed to hire for, the program they had didn't quite cover enough that we needed. And I said honestly to him, like, I love what you're doing, it's just we need a little bit more. And he said, no problem, you know, I'm gonna introduce you to some more investors.
Mm-hmm.
And let's have a conversation. So we went for coffee, we're chatting about various different things about ProdSide, my story. And then at the end of that meeting, I didn't really know what kind of action I want out of. I didn't want to say, are you gonna invest or not? You know, didn't feel like I want to push my luck. And these two investors said, you know, yeah, we're interested. And that ended up in us having another conversation and then a verbal commitment for investment, which I then leveraged to basically use with other investors as a proof of, you know, that there's someone interested.
Yes.
And then we ended up closing that round in about 4 months in total from the beginning to end.
Okay, that's nice. That's actually not bad at all. I think lots of people expect to spend lots of time, but then you never exactly know. Like, you try to be super proactive and try to condense everything, but it's hard to also keep to this time frame. So yeah, that's super interesting. Also, are you already preparing for the next one? Like, it's pre-seed now, so seed is coming at some point, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
Are you already like preparing for that? Have you already maybe talked to people that you weren't exactly the right fit right now, but maybe for the next round you could be a better fit?
You know, that's absolutely part of it. I think once you start fundraising, there's always going to be investors you've spoken to, it wasn't the right time. There's going to be investors that discover you because you did the round.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a constantly evolving process. So I guess as a founder, you're always fundraising because you never know when you're going to meet somebody. If you do that actively, sometimes it might be too late in the process. And if you try and rush around, that, you know, could lead to all kinds of bad outcomes for all sides. So, you know, there's been conversations as part of this round that, you know, we're at that stage where maybe we don't have enough traction, or there's proof points to convince and do a bigger round. So those conversations are ongoing, but there's also lots of people to meet. However, you know, as a founder, you also need to prioritize what's important. There's always like one or two burning things. The fundraising, you know, just after closing a round, although it's a great time to speak to investors, you don't want to make that your number one priority.
Sure.
Because you're not going to get the work done product-wise or customer acquisition-wise to the point where it is actually attractive 6 months down the line.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm taking slow on that side in the first quarter, and then probably going to have more conversations and more focus on that. But we're obviously starting a new year with a fresh round of funding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have budgeted for a few new roles, but we're not rushed to close anything that wouldn't make sense. And, you know, it's a good place to be.
What are the first role that you are going to try to bring on board in the company now? Do you have a specific focus on a few roles that you want to hire right now?
Yeah, so the first role was the head of marketing.
Mm-hmm.
To someone really own, you know, it says head of marketing, but it's really kind of the entire commercial role.
Okay.
You know, in a startup, you kind of have a lot of different hats. So it's customer acquisition, ranging from, you know, getting leads in to
mm-hmm.
the sales process, to how we, you know, make sure they're successful, and then how to make sure we re-engage with people that maybe didn't quite find the right fit at that time. So I'm really happy to bring someone named Amneet,
mm-hmm.
who has worked in a few SaaS companies before and kind of done similar things, and now wants to do it again and have that ownership in an early stage company. So we are already working on a few different things for that, and I'm really excited to have another brain thinking about commercial.
Mm-hmm.
And the three remaining roles are front-end engineering, back-end engineering, and data science.
Okay.
With its kind of NLP specialism.
Mm-hmm.
And we're looking to hire these roles as soon as we can, and we're interviewing candidates, kind of running that process now. So obviously, if there's anyone who knows React or Python and want to, you know, learn more about Prodsight, you know, always welcome to hear from.
That's great to hear. Also, is there anything that you wish you knew before starting fundraising, or something that you had to learn the hard way along the way?
I think I didn't quite appreciate how important it is to have a coherent story that people can easily understand,
mm-hmm.
and get behind and see how it connects back to their own experiences, and then tell that in a way that's not some kind of structured formulaic pitch or waiting to get questions asked, but weave into like a coherent conversation.
Yeah.
And I think to me it's like story. What is a story? I'm not gonna like write a book here. You know, I'm trying to sell this business. I need capital. So my focus was a lot on metrics and proof points.
Okay.
But over time, as I had more conversations and I relaxed a little bit,
mm-hmm.
That and also hearing how people respond. So you'd say something like a proof point that seems interesting to you. See how people react. If they react positively or if that triggers follow-up questions, you can then make that part of your story, and that happens naturally kind of
yes.
behind the scenes. So I would say my recommendation for founders fundraising is don't be afraid to have conversations without having all those things figured out. But then like with each conversation, you should learn something about how the investor responded to then take back and iterate your pitch. But I don't want to call it a pitch because it's not really a pitch. It's always a conversation
mm-hmm.
that has like modular bits of little stories
mm-hmm.
there. For example, what a customer has done with your product or the type of customer you acquired or, you know, how they discovered you. All of those little things kind of answer various investor questions. But if they're part of a cohesive journey, then it's more interesting to listen to than a straightforward pitch, which is like point A, point B, point C.
I think for that, office hours organized by venture capital firms
mm-hmm.
is super helpful, because even if you're not at the right stage,
mm-hmm.
you can have and learn a lot from the question they ask you. And so I've been mentoring lots of startups during some events sometimes, and I think what's really important for them is to hear the kind of question and tell them that's what is the kind of question people are going to ask you as soon as you're going to start pitching them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's super helpful for any entrepreneur. So office hours, I would definitely recommend for that. So I think it's a good
yeah.
exercise point if you don't have in your network already the intro to investors.
I think absolutely. Investors obviously will ask more specific questions, but sometimes even speaking to founders or
mm-hmm.
like
yes.
someone completely random in a meetup, you know, that gives you that opportunity to practice.
Yes.
So, yeah.
You also mentioned that you moved from Edinburgh to London just a few months ago. And I'm wondering, did you feel that you really needed to be in London to fundraise, to grow the team, or did you just want to, or did you feel that there was a pressure to be in London for that?
Well, to be fair, I'm kind of still between Edinburgh and,
okay.
and London. So we have a home there, and we're hiring for an NLP role. So we have a relationship with the University of Glasgow
mm-hmm.
and Edinburgh University, where there's a lot of very talented people coming out of academia with strong NLP focus.
Okay.
So we actually, like our big future plan is to build out this data science team
mm-hmm.
over time, starting with one person, but then adding more based in Edinburgh. And
okay.
because it's actually a brilliant place to live and work. And there's a lot of talent, which is obviously at a smaller scale than London. But for that particular specialism is a great, great location. So I'm still back and forth. I have a lot of friends there. I love other founders. So it's nice to kind of come back and see how they're doing and make introductions when necessary
yes.
or when it makes sense. London is the reason I'm spending time here is because of two things. Personal side is my wife was working at Skyscanner and wanted to move on to a different role here.
Okay.
And that just felt like a natural step for her, and I wanted to support that. So that was maybe like 50% of the reason.
Mm-hmm.
The second part was me kind of thinking in the back in my head, you know, I used to come up here for meetings and things, and I realized the differences in this scene and how much more there's going on here, especially as it comes to like venture capital
yes.
and experienced founders being available for mentorship and just, you know, having a chat. And it's kind of like everything's like 10x almost. So being part of that felt like it would be a good stage. Now that we, you know, went through that initial stage of finding the product, you know, building it, getting some customers, in a quieter environment where you can, you know, kind of really reflect on things, being in London now and being able to leverage that foundation and have conversations with relevant people actually led to a lot of good things. And obviously one of those was, you know, TrueSight joining around. That came through a founder I met at Google Campus, actually. He's running a startup called Claimer. And yes. We were just talking about what they're doing. And he said, you know, I know these investors, they're really cool. You should have a chat. And we did and have a few good conversations. Mm-hmm. And that led to that participation in a round, which is great. You know, that's how it should be, you know, the network.
Yeah.
Helping each other and connecting the right people.
It kind of brings me to my next question, where I want to know more about your own journey, because you already have co-founded other projects in the past. You've been working with lots of startups on the product side. So I want to know more, because it seems to have a very entrepreneurial mindset and to also embrace the community, because I kind of had a sense that you were super active in the north in the startup scene. So I want to know more about what you're doing really and your past experience also.
Yeah, so I kind of had this. So basically, I'm originally from Lithuania, and I came here for studies in Glasgow in 2008. So as I was studying, obviously I needed cash to support myself. Coming back to the point, I don't have friends and family that can, you know, invest in my startup or fund me through the whole thing. So, you know, for me the option was, you know, I could get some kind of job on the side and, you know, and make it work. A lot of my friends did that. But I also kind of was very interested in kind of making something myself, even if it's small. So the very first venture I started was an online store, essentially selling secondhand drums and cymbals and percussion. And
you're a drummer.
Because I connected the two dots. I knew roughly how to build a website.
Yeah.
And I liked that, you know, like computers. And then I was like, what do I know about? And I listed a few different things. I knew about computers, like parts and maybe mobile phones and stuff like that. And then drums was like an interesting one. I thought probably not a lot of people are selling good quality secondhand stuff. And I know like what's good and you know, what's the fair price for it. So I thought I'm going to combine those two and build a website. So I did that. And run that for about 4 years, actually, throughout my entire university.
Oh, wow.
As a side thing, I didn't like spend all that much time. So the operations were like finding good stuff on Gumtree or eBay or friends I made, buying their equipment that they don't want anymore, cleaning it off, making good photographs and selling on eBay or on my website. And I was just kind of making a little bit of money on the side to, you know, fund my rent and stuff like that. But also the side benefit was I could play around with all this cool kit, you know. I would buy the stuff I liked and that, you know, I had the opportunity to go into rehearsal room and then play around with it. So that was a side benefit. And then I also was kind of thinking, this business kind of doesn't scale. Either like I build a big warehouse and like kind of run like a retail business, or I could build something digital that scales beyond what I'm capable to do or people I could hire to do work, like manual work. So I started a few different ideas with my friends. The first one was a social network for the campus we were on. So we wanted to create a space where new students, especially freshers, could discover society events. And the Facebook groups didn't quite exist at that time. So we built this simple website, which, you know, had society profiles, their events, allowed them to buy memberships, sell memberships and manage them. And we launched with a big launch party because we thought we need to launch things. And like about 600 students came along for that, and we had prizes and we had like free beer and pizza.
Sounds really fun.
And it was fun. I was like, wow, this is really stressful, but it's really cool at the same time. But then Facebook groups came along and everyone was like, oh, but people are already on Facebook. Why would we use some kind of third-party website? And then the forces of what, you know, the network effects kind of went away from us. Then we realized, even if it was successful, how would we monetize this thing? Students don't have money, and it's almost like it should be like a charity thing or part of the university website. So we abandoned that idea and pivoted into something that was relying on existing events. Mm-hmm. So we built integrations with Ticketmaster, Skiddle, a few other websites that basically were selling tickets. And we moved to this idea of an aggregated event portal where we look at your interests, like the bands you like, the venues you go to, the genres of music, for example, you like, and match you up with events. And then we would get affiliate commission from successful sales. So we launched that, and there was just two of us, me and my current wife, actually, were working on this. And we were getting some traction, but we didn't really know how to scale a consumer brand like that.
Okay.
And we were coming up to our graduation time, and we had this thing which is kind of like, it's kind of working, but it's failing, and we don't really know how to grow it.
Mm-hmm.
Without like real work experience, and wanting to graduate and just move on. And we just decided to park the project,
okay,
graduate, get our jobs, get some experience and work with other people. And that's what happened. So she went into marketing and went to Skyscanner eventually, where she worked for most of that time. And I went into product management, where we were working on mobile applications.
But that's lots of opportunities to try to launch something, iterate. It's interesting, over the past few months, I've interviewed lots of people who actually started super early when they were still students. And it's super interesting to see that it's okay to start a project, evaluate if it works. If you see that it's not going anywhere, that's okay to stop it and to move on to the next step. But it's super fascinating to see that too. I mean, that's a lot of you know, experience to experiment and to try what worked, what doesn't, and also to try it working with other people, which is always kind of tricky, right?
It is, but you know, I feel that those experiences just layered one on top of each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people hit it lucky the first time, they start the venture and then successfully sell it, and then they're a serial entrepreneur. Although, you know, I've tried a few ventures, I don't yet think of myself as having any kind of success in my belt. I just have a lot of different experiences of like touching things and mm-hmm. seeing how they could go wrong or could go right. And I think that foundation allowed me to move further than any other venture with ProdSide because of those past experiences,
yeah.
Not because I'm lucky this time around. And I feel like if I was to try another startup in a few years, I'd probably do it even better in some way, you know. But one thing you need to not forget is that, you know, you need to create something useful. And I think that's why this process of like finding out what people actually need, especially in the crowded market, but there's so many products being launched. I think that's like the foundation.
Yes.
And if you can internalize this need to have truth about what your customers need, I think that will increase your odds beyond anything.
2 weeks ago, I had Freddie from OU who came here, and we discussed many things, but he mentioned at some point that for him, what was super important was to join a company where he could find mentorship and be surrounded by people who inspire him. And I'm wondering what has been the most helpful thing for you in your journey so far? Has it been having those kind of different experiencing, experimenting with different projects, or has it been anything else that have been helpful for you to move on?
Yeah, so I think the most helpful thing was actually, finally, although the startup experiences I've done where it was like me or my friends working on it mm-hmm. were helpful, the most helpful experience was actually joining the startup. Well, it was an agency that turned into a startup. It kind of spun out the project internally. And being essentially able to work with a bigger team
mm-hmm.
of people where, you know, we need to decide what we build. You know, there's, you know, that we had four engineers, so they needed to work on the right things, and they were smart people, and kind of being part of that environment where there's more accountability than just yourself, and obviously there's like more kind of funding going into it, so you need to make sure it's like well spent. And but then also at the same time being that given that freedom to, you know, run my process and do my research and kind of essentially do create a startup, but without being the actual owner of it. And I think everything that I saw the founders do is now my reference point of what I should do. So if there's like a staff issue, how do they react? What do they do? If there's a morale issue, you know, how do they address that? And that's the kind of stuff that becomes part of your operating. And I think that's why a lot of people say, like, if you want to build a startup, join like Google or Facebook or like a big company.
Mm-hmm.
Because you will then use those examples to learn from and run your own company. And I think, you know, those early experiences will be definitive, and I'm very grateful for that experience I had and that trust in me. But at the same time, there's so many other things that contributes, you know, all the content online, you know, the Y Combinator, they're very outspoken about their way of running startups and might not always apply to startups based in Scotland or UK. You know, US is a slightly different culture, but ingesting that learning, reading the books like Lean Startup and the hard thing about hard things, and you know, and then but also the community, like going to events and hearing local founders speak, those experiences are more relatable in the environment you're in, and then obviously you can build a relationship and kind of learn more as you go and have a sounding board. And then obviously in Scotland we actually have a lot of support networks where there is like you could get a mentor allocated to you, and then they would walk you through not necessarily how to build your product, but like how to hire people, how to set up your legals and stuff like that. And it's kind of, there's no one thing. It's just, you know, being in the community and being around the environment that is kind of conducive to what you're doing and just learning.
You were also exhibiting at TechCrunch in November in Germany, right? Is there any other place where people can find you, maybe to hear more about what you're doing or just catch your brain? Any upcoming events or maybe something online also?
Yeah, so obviously, you know, we have our website, it's prodsci.ai. You know, we have a blog there, so we start writing more content. We have a Medium page, we're on Twitter. So obviously, and we use Intercom ourselves. So, you know, if you go into our website and then write a note, most likely I will read it and I'll respond to it. So that's probably the most direct way. We're, in terms of events, we're heading to Startup Grind Global.
Okay.
In Silicon Valley. So that's 11th to 12th of February, so next month. Very excited to be participating in a conference that size. I've never actually been to San Francisco before, or that part of US. So it's also kind of very exciting. And a thing that I'm doing just before that conference is I'm part of this program called Future X, where a few entrepreneurs from Scotland will participate in a week-long program where we'll meet local entrepreneurs, investors, and community members in Silicon Valley as a way of, you know, taking some of that culture and those learnings back to the UK and Scotland and learn from those and hopefully grow bigger companies than we normally would.
You mentioned so many interesting resources. I'm trying to take notes so I can make sure that I can add them on the below the video.
Sure.
So anyone can reach out and find out more about it. I hope I took note of everything, otherwise I will have to rewatch the entire video. But that is super useful to have just resources, you know.
Yeah.
It's good to say, oh yeah, it's good to be involved in the community, but then having some specific names, specific places, and not in London only, but also online resources is super helpful. So
yeah.
Thank you very much. Is there anything you wish to add that I didn't ask you about, but you want to make a point of it?
Not really. I mean, I like the fact that you're looking at these early stage journeys you know, a lot of the events you see in the community are obviously about successes, because everyone wants that to rub off on them in some way, or at least get a learning or two. But I think it's also important to recognize stories that are like in the making still.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, with things like ProdSight, you know, yes, we were going through those milestones and we were going like getting a bit of funding, building a prototype, getting first customer, first end, beyond that. But, you know, it's not a given that this company will exist in 5 years. And we're still like in the trenches fighting for that survival, because the de facto is, you know, it's like the default state is that it's going to die until you reach that point where it's an inflection and you're like profitable.
Yes.
And it's still a way away. So I think another thing I want to mention that's related to that, the fact that you're doing these types of chats with early stage founders helps other founders relate to those stories and kind of realize, you know, it's actually kind of hard to do these things. And
yes,
the fact that I'm experiencing pushback, whether it's from investors or customers or whatever, is okay, and it's part of the journey. And, you know, these other people went through that or going through that right now, they're available for a chat.
Mm-hmm.
Because the mental state of a founder, you know, because you're like pushing this thing yourself or primarily with your founding team, you know, it gets to you personally sometimes.
Yes.
And you might start questioning, like, why am I even doing this? Like, this is like a hard path. If I'm not going to be successful, like, why did I do it? And I think those stories are part of the support network,
mm-hmm,
where people feel to get like another better life and keep going.
Huge thanks to Tadas for joining me on the stream today, and thanks to all of you for listening to Entrepreneurs Playing Games podcast edition. You can find me on Twitter at AmodinFlax, and be sure to check out and subscribe to my YouTube channel at youtube.com/AmodinFlax. For the full video version of our discussion, all previous interviews, and much more. Also, if you want to join the live stream and ask your own questions to our next guest, Entrepreneurs Playing Games is taking place every 2 weeks on Saturday morning, so keep an eye on our social media, and I hope to see you there very soon.